Getting Better Acquainted with Your Bible, Lesson 4, Special Biblical Subjects, Continued. In obedience to God's command, Moses set up the tabernacle. When the work was finished, a cloud covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. God's glory, this brightness, the visible manifestation of God's presence, is termed in Jewish theology the Shekinah. Israel pitched their tents many times in the 40 years of wandering, and their journeys were made under God's direction. When the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, they went onward. But if the cloud were not taken up, then they journeyed not till the day it was taken up. Paul wrote, "We know that if our earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved, we have a building of God, an house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." Peter wrote, "Ye also, as lively stones, are built up a spiritual house, an holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices, acceptable unto God by Jesus Christ." In Revelation, "Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them." He will tabernacle with them. Let me carry the history of the sanctuary down through the centuries. When the tribes of Israel settled in Canaan, the tabernacle was taken to Shiloh, a town in the territory of Ephraim, where it remained the religious center of worship for over 300 years, until the death of the high priest Eli. Later, David moved the Ark of the Covenant to a tent which he had pitched in Jerusalem. The temple which Solomon built on Mount Zion replaced the tabernacle as the center of worship. In your outline, I have given you the dates for the temples. Solomon's Temple, 959 B.C. The Second Temple, 516. Herod's Temple, 19 B.C. to 64 A.D. Solomon's Temple took 7 years to complete. Sparing no cost, he ordered precious cedar and cypress wood from King Hiram of Tyre. He imposed a levy of 30,000 Israelites to serve in shifts of 10,000, 1 month out of three, and sent them to Lebanon to fell timber. The logs were floated down the coast to the harbor of Joppa and transported overland to Jerusalem. 150,000 Canaanite laborers were sent to the mountains to quarry stone for the foundation and the walls. The Bible records, "The house, when it was in building, was built of stone made ready before it was brought thither, so that there was neither hammer nor axe nor any tool of iron heard in the house while it was in building." Solomon's temple was a magnificent and ornate structure of white limestone. Its general form resembled that of the tabernacle, but its dimensions were double in length and width and triple in height. The temple proper was surrounded on three sides by a low three-storied building, possibly used for storage, and fronted on the east by a stately porch. The temple furniture was similar to that of the tabernacle, except that the brazen altar and laver in the outer court were much larger. There were 10 7-branched candlesticks and 10 tables of showbread. At its solemn dedication, the Shekinah glory filled the temple as it had the tabernacle. The temple established Jerusalem as the center of Israel's worship and elevated Israel's God in the eyes of neighboring nations. It stood for nearly 400 years until its destruction by Nebuchadnezzar in 586. The second temple, sometimes called Zerubbabel's temple, was built after the restoration. It patterned the general lines of the first, but there was a great contrast between the magnificence of the first temple and the simplicity of the second. This temple stood for more than 500 years. Through the centuries, it was repaired and rededicated. Then, in the days of Herod the Great, king of Judea, the temple was rebuilt with great splendor according to the same general plan. It was made of white marble and adorned in the front with plates of gold. The temple area was enlarged to include additional courts, cloisters, porches, and terraces. Herod knew that many of his subjects living in Jerusalem were foreigners, Egyptians, Greeks, Romans, and many others. Therefore, he constructed, for the sake of policy, a large outer court. This was called the Court of the Gentiles. On its south side was the royal porch, constructed of 4 rows of Corinthian columns. Along its western, northern, and eastern sides ran double rows of marble columns. Its eastern colonnade was named Solomon's Porch. The court of the Gentiles was open to all foreigners, but the temple proper was accessible only to the Jews. No foreigner could enter on penalty of death. This was the temple to which Jesus came, the one he cleansed, the one in which he taught and healed, and whose destruction he prophesied. It was the veil in Herod's temple which was rent asunder on the day of crucifixion. A sign to men, one commentator says, that henceforth they would have free access to the Father through the atoning sacrifice of his Son. Herod's temple, begun in 19 BC, was completed between 62 and 64 AD, and utterly destroyed scarcely 6 years later in the year 70, in the siege of Jerusalem by Titus and his Roman army. Ark of the Covenant. Ask yourself the same question. Can I describe the Ark of the Covenant? And can I explain its function? The Ark of the Covenant was a small chest of acacia wood, 2 1/2 cubits in length, 1 1/2 cubits in breadth and height, inlaid and overlaid with gold. It contained the two tables of the law, a pot of manna, and Aaron's rod, which had budded. The lid of the chest was made of pure gold and was called the mercy seat. On this lid, two cherubim of beaten gold faced each other. They looked toward the mercy seat with their wings outstretched to cover it. The wings of the cherubim typified the throne of God, and the mercy seat represented his footstool. In this manner, God's presence in the midst of his people was symbolized. There I will meet with thee, and I will commune with thee from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubims which are upon the ark of the testimony. Note the development from the anthropomorphic conception of God to a more spiritual one. For we read in Isaiah, "The heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool." The ark was the sole object in the Holy of Holies. On the Day of Atonement, the high priest stood before it to offer incense and to sprinkle the blood of the sin offerings on the mercy seat for the propitiation of his own sins and those of the nation. The historical scriptures show the sanctity of the ark as the material symbol of the divine presence. It was regarded with such reverence that it was never touched. It was always carried by two poles inserted through loops on its sides. During the marches of Israel in the wilderness, the ark was covered with the veil that was used to screen off the Holy of Holies, and it was borne in advance of the host with great care by the Levites. Before the Ark of the Covenant, the waters of Jordan separated. The Ark was present with the Israelites in their procession around Jericho. Its issue to battle and its return from battle were considered those of God himself. From the time of Joshua to the time of Samuel, a period of over 300 years, the Ark of the Covenant was in the tabernacle at Shiloh. At the close of the high priest Eli's life, the Ark was captured in battle by the Philistines. The Philistines carried this sacred object to Ashdod and set it up in the house of their god, Dagon. On the morrow, Dagon was fallen upon his face. They set him in his place. When they returned, again he had fallen, and his head and the palms of his hands had been cut off. The hand of the Lord was heavy upon them of Ashdod. The Philistines were so oppressed while the ark was in their possession that at the end of 7 months they put it on a cart and returned it, and it was placed in the house of Abinadab at Kirjath-Jearim. Later, David came with 30,000 of his chosen men to remove it to Jerusalem. The ark was set upon a new cart, which Uzzah and Ahio drove. As they rode, the oxen shook it, and Uzzah put out his hand to steady the ark, and he died there. Uzza's act was a sacrilege, a breach of the law. And David was afraid of the Lord that day. 3 months later, with great celebration, David brought the ark to Jerusalem and set it in a tent which he had pitched on Zion. Later, when Solomon built the temple, the Ark of the Covenant was placed in its Holy of Holies. What became of the Ark is not known. It may have been carried away when Jerusalem was plundered by Shishak of Egypt, about 930 B.C., or by Nebuchadnezzar when Jerusalem fell in 586. The consensus of scholars is that it did not appear in the Second Temple. In the book of Revelation, we hear again of the tabernacle, the temple, the altar of incense, or the golden altar, the court of the Gentiles, and the Ark of the Testament, or the Ark of the Covenant. Before we take up the remaining subjects in the outline, let me speak briefly on biblical archaeology, for its findings are continually confirming the accuracy of the biblical record. Palestinian archaeology began in 1835 AD. Since that time, scholars of many nations have been digging in the Middle East. The sites of many ancient civilizations have been discovered by what are called tells, or mounds of debris, which had been covered by the dust of centuries. Cutting down through layers of rubbish, excavators have found many a city rebuilt on the same spot. Well over 1,000 sites have been examined and listed. Among the many discoveries are the ruins of early Canaanite cities and temples, the walls of Jericho, which fell, the Jebusite walls of Jerusalem, the Siloam Tunnel built by King Hezekiah, a portion of the wall and gate of the city of Samaria, with its street of colonnades built by King Omri of Israel. At Megiddo, excavators have found evidence of 20 successive layers of cities built from 3500 to about 350 B.C. They peeled off the first 4 layers down to the chariot city of Solomon, and found Solomon's stables, which provided for more than 500 horses. In the Araba Rift, which runs south of the Dead Sea to the Gulf of Aqaba, Dr. Nelson Gluck, author of Rivers in the Desert, discovered the great iron and copper mines of King Solomon, including the very furnaces, miners' huts, and slag heaps. He located also the port of Ezion-Geber at the head of the Gulf of Aqaba, from which Solomon's navies sailed. Archaeology has also uncovered rich evidence of Old Testament Hebrew life, dye vats, weapons, tombs, pottery. Added to the evidence of Hebrew life are the discoveries relating to the New Testament era, Roman temples, theaters, forts, palaces. Excavations, 1963 to 1965, of Masada, an ancient fortress town on the western bank of the Dead Sea, have uncovered the summer palace of King Herod the Great, the mountain fortress in which 960 Jewish zealots made their last stand against the Romans in the year 72 AD. Then comes the question of how to place the various discoveries in point of time. Archaeologists have been able to establish the dates of these antiquities with remarkable accuracy. Today, the science of pottery identification has been developed to such a high degree that from broken fragments of pottery alone, they can determine the span of civilizations. Out of 1,000 years, they can now approximate the correct date to within 100 years. Thousands of clay tablets have been found and translated. About 1/10 of these relate to worship, customs, and religion. Among them are the Tell El Amarna tablets found in Egypt in 1888, the Ras Shamra tablets discovered in northern Syria in 1924, and the Lachish letters found in the Judean foothills in 1935. In addition, invaluable ancient manuscripts written on fragile papyri and brittle skins have come to light. In 1894 began the great series of discoveries of papyri, and since that time a constant stream of texts has flowed into the libraries of Europe and America. Among the latest manuscripts are the Qumran manuscripts, or Dead Sea Scrolls, scrolls of leather. The first of these were discovered in 1947 in a cave in the Judean hills near the Dead Sea. The most recent were found between 1963 and 1965 at Masada. It is believed that the majority of these scrolls belong to the Essenes, a strict monastic sect which made their home in the mountainous area near the Dead Sea, and that these writings were hidden just before the fall of Jerusalem in the year 70 AD, when Rome was ravaging Judea. It is an inspiring fact that scholars agree that not one of the archaeological findings alters the articles of Christian faith, and that not one changes the substance of Christian doctrine. To return to the subjects in your outline. Cities of refuge. Of the 48 cities allotted to the Levites by Joshua, 6 were to be cities of refuge. 3 west of the Jordan, Kedesh, Shechem, Hebron, and 3 east of the Jordan, Golan, Ramoth, and Bezer. These 6 cities were appointed by Mosaic law as asylums to which any man could flee for safety if he had caused the death of a human being. There he could find refuge until a fair trial could be held to determine whether the deed had been done wittingly or unwittingly. a deliberate murderer was turned over to the avenger. But protection was extended to the one who had committed this crime without premeditation. If he were innocent, he shall dwell in that city until the death of the high priest. Then shall the slayer return unto his own city. The positions of these six cities were so chosen that fugitives could always reach one of them within a day's journey. And a day's journey was a distance of 30 miles. The thought of refuge had a special significance for the children of Israel. We read, "The eternal God is thy refuge. The God of Jacob is thy refuge." Threshing floors. Let us catch a glimpse of a threshing floor. It was a circular piece of hard ground where sheaves of grain were laid. To loosen the grain, these sheaves were either beaten with a hand flail or trampled under the hooves of unmuzzled oxen as they paced round and round. The fan was a pronged fork which was used to throw the grain up against the wind. Because of the breeze, evening was the favorite time to winnow, or to separate the chaff from the grain. The chaff was blown away, the lighter morsels at a shorter distance, and the heavy grains fell at the winnower's feet. Gideon was threshing when he was called to lead the armies of Israel against the enemy. David was at the threshing floor of Araunah on Mount Zion when he envisioned the house of the Lord. And later, his son Solomon built the temple on the site of that threshing floor. The prophets likened the whole earth to God's great threshing floor, subject to sifting by his judgment. From Isaiah, "Behold, I will make thee a new sharp threshing instrument having teeth. Thou shalt thresh the mountains and beat them small, and shalt make the hills as chaff." Daniel predicted that the four heathen kingdoms of Nebuchadnezzar's dream would become like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. John the Baptist said, "One mightier than I cometh, whose fan is in his hand, and he will thoroughly purge his floor, and will gather the wheat into his garner, but the chaff he will burn with fire unquenchable." The mountains. Think what part the mountains played in the history of these people. The term is used metaphorically in almost every book of the Bible, in the sense of strength and as a summit of highest spiritual exaltation. Psalms speaks of the mountain of God's holiness. Isaiah says, "The mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and all nations shall flow unto it." John saw the vision of the holy Jerusalem from a great and high mountain. At Mount Sinai, or Horeb, the law was given to Moses. On Horeb, Elijah heard the still, small voice. At Mount Nebo, Moses saw all the promised land. On Mount Carmel, Elijah successfully challenged the priests of Baal. Jesus' transfiguration took place probably on Mount Hermon. Jesus went often to the Mount of Olives. And Jesus' ascension took place at the Mount of Olives. Jordan. The Jordan is the great river of Palestine, rising high among the foothills of Mount Hermon. It flows in a short distance by steep descent into the Sea of Galilee, 700 feet below sea level. The name Jordan means descender, the river that rushes down. The Sea of Galilee is approximately 13 miles long and 7.5 miles wide. It is also known as the Sea of Tiberias, the Lake of Gennesaret, the Lake of Chinnereth. From there, the Jordan flows south by a very winding course, emptying into the Dead Sea, or Salt Sea, nearly 1,300 feet below sea level. The Dead Sea is the lowest body of water on the surface of the earth. Its only outlet is by evaporation. It is so salty, nothing can live within it. Although the distance between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea is about 65 miles, the actual course of the Jordan covers nearly 200 miles. There were several fords. However, not a single city ever crowned its banks, but many travelers paused there before crossing. Throughout the history of the chosen people, the Jordan was a symbol of protection and of defense. And because of its sacred associations with Israel's history, it acquired a spiritual significance. With my staff, I passed over it, said Jacob. The children of Israel crossed over on dry ground. Elijah and Elisha parted its waters. John the Baptist baptized the multitudes in the Jordan. And in the Jordan, Jesus was baptized. Jerusalem, Zion. Abraham knew the city as Salem. Joshua as Debuzi, the city of the Jebusites. And David as Jerusalem. The word Jerusalem means foundations of peace, a habitation of peace. The city is on the edge of one of the highest tablelands of the country, 2,500 feet above sea level. The tableland is bounded by two main valleys, the Kidron to the east and the Hinnom to the south and west. The city itself is built on several levels. When one approaches from the south, there is only a slight ascent. But to the traveler approaching from the north, the east, or the west, it presents the appearance of a mountain city. Its first wall, or Old Wall, was built by David and enlarged by Solomon. When Nehemiah rebuilt the wall, he included the territory added by the earlier kings. The third wall to the north was built by King Agrippa several years after the crucifixion, and parts of this wall have been found. Jerusalem was besieged many times. Twice the city was completely destroyed and its walls leveled, by Nebuchadnezzar in 586 B.C. and by the Romans in 70 A.D. Zion was chief of the four hills on which Jerusalem was built. Zion means fortress or citadel. In Psalms we read, "They that trust in the Lord shall be as Mount Zion, which cannot be removed." David built his palace on Mount Zion, and it became known as the City of David. Zion was also called the Hill of the Sanctuary, because the Ark of the Covenant was placed in a sanctuary located on Zion. Later, Solomon built the temple there. Jerusalem thus became the center of Israel's religious worship, the capital of all of Judah's kings for more than 400 years, and the home of many of its prophets. Zion is frequently the designation for Jerusalem itself, as well as for the temple area. Zion is used as a symbol of the city of God. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God hath shined. To psalmist, priest, prophet, and New Testament writers, Jerusalem and Zion had a spiritual significance. The term New Jerusalem is found only in the book of Revelation and designates the city which lieth four square, having none of the imperfections of its earthly counterpart. Signs and miracles. It was not an unusual thing for the people of that day to look for signs. The dictionary definition of a sign is, in part, a mark, an indication, a proof, that which furnishes evidence, any symbol or emblem which prefigures, typifies, or represents an idea. Miraculous signs and wonders visibly attested the supremacy and might of the invisible God whom Israel worshipped. Exodus 4th chapter tells of the rod in Moses' hand and of the leprous hand. "And it shall come to pass, if they will not believe thee, neither hearken to the voice of the first sign, that they will believe the voice of the latter sign." Luke, 2nd chapter. "I bring you good tidings of great joy, and this shall be a sign unto you. Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger." Many kinds of miracles are mentioned in the Old Testament. Miracles of guidance, the pillar of cloud and of fire, During the Exodus from Egypt, the Israelites were guided and guarded by a pillar of cloud by day and of fire by night. The budding of Aaron's rod. Following the rebellion of Korah and his company against the Aaronic priesthood, Moses placed 12 rods before the Ark of the Covenant to represent the 12 tribes of Israel. Aaron's rod, which represented the tribe of Levi, budded, blossomed, and bore fruit overnight, a sign confirming this tribe to priestly service and the choice of Aaron and his family to the priesthood. Miracles of judgment. Destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah by brimstone and fire for the iniquitous sodomy of their inhabitants. Jeroboam's altar rent and his hand withered. At the word of the prophet from Judah, the idolatrous altar set up by apostate King Jehoram was rent. And when the king lifted his hand against the prophet, it was arrested and withered in mid-air. At the prophet's prayer, the king's hand was restored. Miracles of protection and deliverance. Deliverance of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the fiery furnace. Deliverance of Daniel in the lion's den. Miracles of God's care. Israel fed with manna in the wilderness. Elijah fed by ravens. The widow's oil multiplied by Elisha. Miracles of healings and raisings. Healing of Miriam's leprosy. Healing of Naaman's leprosy. Raising of the widow's son by Elijah. Raising of the Shunammite's son by Elisha. Windows. Windows are mentioned many times in Scripture, both literally and figuratively. A window is an opening for the admission of light or air, also an outlet for escape. The ark shall have a window. Noah opened the window at the end of 40 days and sent out a dove. Rahab let Joshua's spies down safely through her window. Daniel opened his windows toward Jerusalem. In Malachi, "Prove me now herewith, saith the Lord of hosts, if I will not open you the windows of heaven and pour you out a blessing, that there shall not be room enough to receive it." Angels. You recall that an angel came to Abraham, to Moses, to Gideon, to Elizabeth, to Mary, to Joseph, to Jesus, and to many others. Angels were God's messengers. They were sometimes called men, sometimes sons of God, sons of the mighty, princes, holy ones, keepers, watchers, the host of heaven. They guided men. An angel guided the children of Israel on their way to the promised land. Behold, I send an angel before thee to keep thee in the way and to bring thee into the place which I have prepared. They were protectors of men. He shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways. They were referred to as watchmen. I have set watchmen upon thy walls, O Jerusalem, which shall never hold their peace day nor night. Angels played a part in the birth of John the Baptist and in the birth of Jesus. Angels were present at Jesus' temptation and were with him in Gethsemane. Jesus spoke of angels. He told how numerous. Thinkest thou that I cannot now pray to my Father, and he shall presently give me more than 12 legions of angels? He called attention to their appearance with his second coming, and it was in this connection that most of his references to angels were made. Hereafter ye shall see heaven open, and the angels ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his works. The Day of the Lord. The Day of the Lord early meant the day when God would show favor to his people by delivering them from oppression and injustice, and would exalt them in the eyes of the nations. The message of the prophets was a moral message. Repeatedly they warned of the Day of the Lord, to them a great and terrible day of judgment. A plumb line had been set in the midst of the people. God would not pass by Israel anymore. God would reveal himself as a God of righteousness. Thus, with the thought of a righteous God, came the idea that all unrighteousness would fall under judgment, and that the final judgment would come on the Day of the Lord. The thought of glory lies behind this Day of the Lord, when a righteous remnant shall be saved and established. Jesus spoke of the gathering out of his kingdom all things that offend, and of the gathering in of the righteous. This is seen fulfilled in prophecy in the book of Revelation. Seed. The word seed is found in Scripture with both literal and figurative meanings. It is used repeatedly in the sense of human posterity. Paul used it figuratively. If ye be Christ's, then are ye Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. Peter spoke of Christians as being born again of incorruptible seed. Seed is used figuratively for the Word of God. Jesus used it in this sense in his parables of the sower and the seed, the seed and the tares, and the mustard seed. The remnant. Historically, the remnant referred specifically to the Jews who came back to Judah from Babylonian captivity, chastened and cleansed of polytheism. They returned a willing, holy nation, the living substance of a more dedicated Israel. Isaiah prophesied of the remnant as a tenth, the holy seed. Ezekiel prophesied, "I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen, and will gather them on every side and bring them into their own land." In its deeper significance, the remnant are those who remain faithful, who survive the purging process. The remnant are those who remain true to the divine calling and steadfastly look for redemption. Paul wrote of Jewish Christians, "At this present time also there is a remnant according to the election of grace." In Revelation, the dragon was wroth with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. God's covenant. God's covenant is his everlasting promise or oath to his people, which may be summed up in his words, "I will take you to me for a people, and I will be to you a God." Its essential requirement on the part of men is obedience. A redemptive covenant was made with mankind in the promise of the seed of the woman. This covenant with mankind was established with Noah and his seed after the flood. The covenant idea began to be definitive with the call of Abraham, to whom God said, "I will establish my covenant between thee and me, and thy seed after thee, to be a God unto thee, and to thy seed after thee. And I will give unto thee all the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession." The fuller meaning of this Abrahamic covenant, to be a God and to give a land, unfolded only gradually. The covenant was renewed with Israel as a nation when they were given the Ten Commandments and their laws. It was renewed with the new generation of Israel as they were about to enter the Promised Land. The last of the Old Testament covenants was made with David, in which he was promised a seed, a throne, and a kingdom forever. As you see, the children of Israel were continually reminded of God's covenant. It was renewed, amplified, and ratified again and again. All of these Old Testament covenants were fulfilled in Jesus Christ, the Emmanuel, God with us, who became the mediator of the new covenant, which Jeremiah had foretold. The Old Testament conception of God's covenant, as made with Israel, yielded to the New Testament conception of God's covenant, as made with spiritual Israel. And God's relationship to man is seen to be an individual relationship, an indwelling covenant. In the Epistle to the Hebrews, we read of the new covenant, the one great covenant of the New Testament. This is the covenant which I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my laws into their mind and write them in their hearts, and I will be to them a God, and they shall be to me a people. And they shall not teach every man his neighbor, and every man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, for all shall know me, from the least to the greatest. Thus we reach the close of Old Testament history. We have seen that these people came and came and came. There was always a new beginning. They journeyed and journeyed and journeyed. The spiritual lessons of Israel's journeys are the heritage of all men. And the spirit of Israel's journeys may be caught in these few meaningful words. The promise of a Redeemer, the turning to God, an ark, a calling and a covenant, a new name, a preservation, a law, a reliance, a heritage, a discipline, a uniting, a temple, a dividing or separation, a captivity, a remnant, and a restoration. Looking forward to the New Testament, let us glimpse four great solitary figures standing before entrenched political power. Moses before Pharaoh, Elijah before King Ahab, Jesus before Pontius Pilate, Paul before Herod Agrippa. Think also of the ascent of Moses to Mount Sinai, there to receive the law. The ascent of Elijah to Mount Horeb, there to hear the still, small voice. The ascent of Jesus to the Mount of Transfiguration, there to hear God's commendation. This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. And the ascent of John, as recorded in the book of Revelation, to a great and high mountain, there to be shown that great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. Acknowledgement is made for permission to quote from a Dictionary of the Bible by William Smith, published by Fleming H. Revell Company. This concludes lesson 4. Please fast forward to end of tape. Lesson 5 begins on cassette 5.